Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. And we're in at this the weekly podcast of today's Football Times. And I've got a couple of co-hosts with me today, looking at a couple of current events, three current events, and looking further forward next couple of weeks, months, or even years further forward. So, firstly, to introduce my first co-host, and my name's Gary Thacker, I forgot to mention that, is Aidan Williams. Welcome, Aidan. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing good, Gary. Looking forward to this one. It's good to be back on the regular weekly pod.
First time for me as well for a while. I haven't been on one of these for a while, so yeah, it's good to be back on look at the current situation. And my second co-host is Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, welcome on board, buddy.
Yeah, it's great to be back again, Gary. I'll just echo what Aidan said. It's good to have the gang back together again. It feels a bit like that Michael Palin episode of Barnsley where he gets the old team back from the 1920s to win league titles. So it definitely has a bit of a retro vibe about it.
Ripping yarns and all that sort of thing, buddy, yeah.
Oh, fantastic series. Fantastic.
Yeah, brilliant, yeah. Before we get into the topics we're going to discuss tonight, obviously, I just want to give us each a chance to have a little word about the departure of one of the football stars from the 70s and 80s, Francis Lee. Aidan, perhaps a little bit before your time, but thoughts about Francis Lee and his departure, buddy?
It's definitely before my time. I knew him best for his takeover of Man City in the mid-90s, I guess it was. Sitting there in his bright blue blazer in the stands, overlooking proceedings, looking every inch not former professional footballer, because he'd put on a few pounds by this stage. So what I learned about him and his playing exploits was through the prism of seeing him at that stage of his career, and then hearing all about his toilet roll business and seeing the skits on the Fantasy Football TV show of him sort of running around the pitch picking up bits of litter to use in his toilet roll business, where he obviously became rather successful. I've seen, obviously, since then, clips of him in some of City's great teams of the late 60s, early 70s, and the 1970 World Cup, of course, where I was interested to read he was the first England player to receive a card at a World Cup for kicking the Brazilian goalkeeper, Felix. So there you go. If there's something to be proud of, that was it.
Pretty good, buddy. Pretty good. Paul, you're more of my generation as well, mate, so we can remember the great days of Francis Lee. And I know he played for Derby at the end, and I think he played for Bolton before, but his great days were as a Man City player, weren't they?
They were, and he's a real kind of throwback footballer, wasn't he? He's a type of footballer who wouldn't make the grade now. He's kind of battle-chested, very stockily built, and he's very, very aggressive, but he's incredibly skillful as well. And he had one of the hardest shots I've ever seen in a footballer. You know, the net would bulge every time he hits it from distance. He's also kind of I think he's one of the few players who's won the league twice with two different clubs in a very short space of time as well, with Man City and with Derby County. I also think he held at one time the record for the most penalties scored in a season. I think he got 15 penalties for Man City in the 71-72 season, which kind of earned him the nickname of Lee One Pen. And it was always like the joke at the time, who's the Chinese footballer who plays for Man City? Oh, it's Lee One Pen. Although he and Leslie had a reputation for diving, he also wouldn't tolerate that from other players. So there's a great clip, if you can find it, in a Manchester derby where he tackles George Best and George Best falls over. And Lee stands behind the ref, just throws himself to the ground in a diving action to try and make out that Best is calling the ref. And I know people these days pay like £25, £35 to watch Tyson Fury or people like this on box office. But for the best free boxing fight you're ever going to see in your life, it's got to be that Francis Lee number Hunter one. It's absolutely brilliant. It's a pure aggression, pure hatred. And if the two of them just been left two, I dread to think of what would have happened. And I even love Lee's quotes. I suppose they mean kind of say, it was a good job they didn't let me in the Lee's dressing room afterwards, because I would have just carried on. So you just don't get that level of aggression from footballers anymore. I mean, you look at people like Joey Bart and say, sorry, mate, you're nowhere near as aggressive as Rob Francis Lee was. So incredibly talented footballer. Obviously a very clever guy as well. I mean, at a time when most ex-footballers either drifted off to be pub managers or gambled it all away or ended lives in penury in some cases. He actually went on to use his spare time, create, as Aidan's referenced there, a thriving toilet roll making paper business. Did it very successfully from it. And it was just kind of unfortunate that when he joined Man City, he didn't quite have the wherewithal, maybe the knowledge or the backing to carry the club further forward. But even though, in terms of a play, he's one of the best players I've ever seen. And as I said at the start, he's the type of player I don't think we'll ever see again.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Paul. One of the great things about having you on, Paul, is you're my generation. One of the things I was going to say, you're pretty well covered there, buddy. one thing I'll just add there is, you know, as you sort of alluded to then, as strikers today, and you look at Francis Lee's build, I mean, he carried you know, a chunky guy, he's like a middleweight boxer, but yeah, a fantastic player and a Manchester City legend. So RIP, Franny, you know, I think all the Sky Blue fans and wearing the Sky Blue shirts of Man City will sort of rise a glass to Francis Lee and his memories. So let's sort of move on to the topics for this week. So our sort of current topics. So we go alphabetically. Aidan, I put you in the firing line first. Before we go onto the sort of forward events, tell us about your current event thoughts. What are you going to focus on, buddy, for this week?
Well, I'm going slightly random. I like to do slightly offbeat things, hopefully, anyway. And with it being International Week, I thought I'd focus on quite a remarkable story of the longest international playing career of any male footballer. And it recently came to an end a couple of weeks ago. And this is for 43-year-old Ildefonso Lima of Andorra. Now, you may not have heard too much about him, but he is a world record holder for his international career. He's a centre-back. He's been 26 years as an international footballer. That is quite some record. From the age of 17, when he made his debut in Andorra's second ever match in June 1997, he even scored in a 4-1 defeat in Estonia. His career, therefore, has also spanned Andorra's entire career and entire time in international football as well. Other than that first match and, you know, one or two in between, he has been there throughout their entire footballing history. Oddly enough, he wasn't even born in Andorra. He moved there when he was only 2 months old. He was born in Barcelona, but, you know, he's effectively a product of Andorra. However, you can't become a citizen of Andorra until you've lived there for 20 years. Now, as I say, he made his debut age 17, so that's a slight problem to begin with. He was still 3 years away from becoming officially Andorran. UEFA, thankfully, in their wisdom, their rare wisdom, they provided special permits to allow Lima and, in fact, a few others who were a little bit away from becoming officially Andorran citizens, allowed them special dispensation to play prior to their 20 years being up. Now, also, you've got to think in a nation of very small numbers, 30-odd thousand, maybe a bit more, perhaps, given they realistically only had a handful of players to pick from who were of sufficient quality to actually take on the rigours of international football. And I obviously don't mean like top international quality, but enough to be able to cope with it. That's very few they had to pick from. So had UEFA not made this concession, I would imagine the national team would have failed before it had even begun. He's now ended up playing 137 times for Andorra, including he's played against Brazil in 1998 in a warm-up match for the 1988 World Cup that summer. So he's faced Ronaldo, Roberto Carlos, Rivaldo et al. That year, with Brazil on their way to the World Cup final, of course. They only lost 3-0, just as France did in the final. He faced France soon after that World Cup, with Andorra holding out in a goalless first half, the headlines exclaiming how they did better than France. Better than Brazil against France in the World Cup final. He only won, however, 6 times in that 137. But each of those, of course, was a major triumph in itself. Now, I'm a big fan of football, international football, from the countries who can never compete at the top. I find it fascinating, those who are lower down the ladder. There's a deep interest for me in these teams and players who take just as much pride in representing their nation, or in some cases, potentially even more, as the top stars do, who get to go to the World Cups, get to go to the Euros and so on. They represent their country with the odds permanently stacked against them, of course. A win of any kind is huge, but more often than not, it's defeats. I mean, things like Nations League may help. Obviously, nations of this size give them competitive internationals that they can realistically hope to win. But a lot of the time, it's qualifiers against teams who they are, let's say, less likely to beat. He's only had six wins, like I say, but there have been several near misses, occasionally late winners denying them and things like that. But therefore, when the win does come along for nations like this, it's huge. As Lima himself said, when you get a win, you celebrate like you've won the World Cup. And that's what I find absolutely delightful. If it's not patronising, and I guess it maybe is slightly, and I don't mean to be, but I do sort of love the stories of people who take such pride in representing a nation at this level. Unsurprisingly, given the length of his career, he is obviously his country's most capped player, but he's also their top scorer. Now, despite being a defender in a team which is pretty much always defending, I think that's quite some achievement as well. To add to his exploits, in June 2021, he became only the third ever European footballer to be capped in four different decades. The other two, Billy Meredith of Wales and Jari Litmanen of Finland. So that's some company to end up in. His final appearance was a couple of weeks ago. He was substituted off to a standing ovation. This was away in Switzerland. And he was replaced by a player who wasn't even born when he started his career. He was only born a few years after Lima started his international career. He would have finished his career sooner also. This is a nice little twist to the tale. He had intended to finish international football with a game against England in the last Euros, or is it even World Cup qualifying, in 2021. However, his suggestion that the whole squad take a COVID test prior to training in England saw him shockingly ostracised from the squad by the Federation, who obviously didn't take things quite as seriously. And that left him out of contention for a year, but he didn't want to finish like that on a sort of sour note, having given so much. And belatedly, there was a change of heart from the Federation. He remained available throughout. And he got to extend his international career by a couple of years as a result, only ending in September 2023. There's a lovely quote. There's an actual great article on him on The Guardian at the moment from Sid Lowe. And there's a lovely quote on there from Lima, which I'll read out because it really captures it all. It says, "I played both Ronaldos. The first didn't score against us. The second filled his boots. And when I look at my shirts, I see Shevchenko, Lewandowski, Bale, Van Persie. I went from Ronaldo Nazario to Mbappe. That marks the passing of time. I didn't play against a generation's idols. I played against lots of generation's idols. Now, I'm a sucker for stories like this. I love the heartwarming aspects of stories far away from the elite." So this is a big dose of praise for the world record holding Ildefonso Lima, and a happy retirement to international football's longest serving player.
What a brilliant story. Can I just ask a quick question? You said he's the record goal scorer. How many goals he scored?
10, I believe.
That's
11. Sorry, I did him a total disservice. 11.
11 from a centre-back playing for Andorra. That's pretty good. You know, it's easy to sort of say, and it says to sort of be quite patronised about this. This is a guy who served his country, through across four decades, as Aidan said there, and played against some of the best players in the world. You know, and the old sort of cliche about the Butcher Baker and Candlestick Maker playing for international teams. It's a bit redundant now in these days, day and ages, isn't it?
Fascinating story, and I have to admit it, this is a gap in my football knowledge. He's not somebody I've come across when I'm reading or writing about football, and it just sounds an absolutely fascinating backstory, a background to how he ended up playing for Andorra, even though he was born in Barcelona. But I kind of guess as well, with Catalan being Andorra's national language and him being in Barcelona, there's no kind of language differences there because you'd adapt that straight away. And you have to admire kind of the resilience of players like this, because what it must be like in your head going out knowing you're going to struggle every game, and most games is going to end up as quite a humiliation. And it always knowing as a defender, we've held off for 10 minutes, can we do another 10? Can we do another 10? It must take incredible powers of character to be able to inspire those around you. And to still be getting picked for your national team at that age, it doesn't matter what standard the national team play at. That is just a fantastic achievement. And I'm actually disappointed he's retiring now, to be honest. I'm sure he can probably have another one or two seasons. I was just checking his playing career earlier, and the number of teams he's played for as well, I think in three or four different countries. So the guy's obviously got a whole wealth of football experience there. And certainly with Gary being based in Spain, you know, if this guy's ever available for a podcast, we've got to get him on. We really have.
Well, he's hugely active on Twitter, actually, Paul. So we should definitely tag him in on Twitter when this goes out, because he's the kind of guy who responds to this kind of thing. We'll have him on.
Absolutely. And we can all wear Andorra national football shirts for the pod as well. So, I mean that's surely got to convince him, hasn't it?
Oh, it's a wonderful story. And, you know, I mean, for any centre-half in any team, any centre-back in any team, to score 11 goals in, you know, 130-odd games is a massive total. So playing for Andorra as well, that's pretty much outstanding. So, yeah.
And you think about the defensive side, as Paul was saying, playing against the bigger teams and the risk of humiliation and so on. I do recall England playing them on a couple of occasions, and Wales equally. Wales managing needing a late winner to beat them 2-1, and England only winning 2-0 over there. You know, so they didn't. At times, I think he references it himself in that article I'm referring to of some 6-0 defeats and so on. But more often than not, they were so organised and, you know, a few of the dark arts and all of that. But, you know, you do what you can to survive. And they didn't get humiliated in the same way that some other small European international teams may do.
Aidan, I thought you made a really good point there. You made a good point there about the Nations League, because I think that's the concept of Nations League. I didn't quite get it at first, but I really understand it now. And the idea of Andorra playing competitive matches when they have a chance of winning against other teams of the same level of ability also must be a brilliant experience for them to actually feel at this level, we've actually got a chance of winning this group, we've got a chance of winning a few matches.
A little bit of actual glory, tangible glory. They could have a promotion and maybe it'll go sour the time after. But, you know, you get a bit of the glory that they wouldn't get to taste otherwise, which is, yeah, a great thing, I think.
Wonderful. So tip of the hat there to Senor Lima. And so we're going to move on to yours, Paul. And it's there again, it's a sort of a less well-known subject you're going to touch on today.
I was going to talk a little bit about the current plight of Tranmere Rovers. Now, I go to see Tranmere about five or six times a season because they're kind of my third team at the moment. I watch Everton, I watch my local non-league team, Marine. I also go to watch Tranmere on a day when I can't get to see either of those other two as well. So we get across there about six, seven times a season. I'm just looking at where they are now in League Two. They're kind of 3 points off the drop zone. And bearing in mind they have fallen out of the Football League once before, back in 14-15, it would just be an incredible loss for football on Merseyside for Tranmere to find themselves out of the league for the second time. You know, to quote Oscar Wilde, you know, for this to happen once, you know, it is unfortunate, but if it happens twice, then the blame's on you. You're faced purely in your own hands. Going back to the 2019-2020 season, which kind of gets forgotten because of the COVID impact. And if you remember at the time, the decision was taken that the Premier League and the Championship would carry on playing behind closed doors, whereas League One, League Two, we decided on this bizarre points per games ratio, with the season having stopped about 10 games before it was due to finish. And Tranmere were quite, unfortunately, victims of their own success, because they'd had a cup run that season. They'd made it through to the fourth round, where they got beat by Man United. And the consequence of that was they kind of fell behind a bit with their fixtures compared to other teams. So when this decision was made and the calculations were kind of put together, Tranmere found themselves in the final relegation place, having played 34 games, which gave them a point ratio of 0.94. The team above them, Wimbledon, stayed up on a point ratio of 1. So basically Tranmere were kind of relegated by 0.06 of a point. And it was even more unfair because they'd just bought in players in the January transfer window and they'd won their last three away games on the bounce. So they were just hitting form at the right time, combined with the cup run, and then suddenly the carpet was pulled away from them. And the consequence was that it had a massive impact on the club because they'd gone from a team that had successive promotions to suddenly being relegated kind of unfairly in their view. And I've got a lot of sympathy with that view as well. During the summer, Mickey Mellon, the manager who brought a lot of success to him, left the club. But also Paul Mullen, who went on to do quite well at Cambridge United and Wrexham, also left the club. So in the consequence of that decision by the Football League was, A, the manager goes to Dundee United, B, Paul Mullen, who goes on to be one of the most effective goal scorers in the Football League, leaves them as well. And they never really recovered from that double blow. And then the following season, they made it to the playoffs, but they went through four managers that season. The team's been like no coherent strategy whatsoever. They fell dismally in the playoffs with a team of aging 30-plus professionals. Following season, Mickey Mellon came back. They were going really well in 20 in that season. And then they were second in the table, had the best defence in the Football League, got beat at home 4-1 by Forest Green Rovers, and then only won 9 out of the remaining 19 games and fell away from the playoff picture. Last season, once again, they didn't really do it, didn't really get a promotion charge going. Mickey Mellon was relieved of his post. And this season, during the summer, they appointed Ian Dawes, who'd been caretaker manager before. It just hasn't worked out. He's lost his job now as well. And they now have Nigel Adkins, who used to be manager of Southampton before Pochettino took over, who's now in charge. And he's kind of a Tranmere legend, and the fans have a lot of faith that he's going to get them safe. And he has seen a slight upturn in their fortunes, not a massive one, but a slight one. They've won two more games under them. And so there's still quite a desperate state there. They need to put a run together. They need to get away from the bottom of that table, because I think with Tranmere being the third team on Merseyside, they have a real floating support. So I said they've got a hardcore of about 5,000 fans who would turn up week in, week out, no matter how bad or good the team is doing. If they're doing well, those gates go up to 11,000, 12,000. You know, I count myself in that kind of group as well. I would go along if they're doing well. And when you're at the Tranmere games, you do hear people talking about their leaders at Everton and Liverpool, but they're there to watch Tranmere. And so the difference financially for Tranmere between doing well and doing not so well is the gates could go up or down by 5,000, 6,000 each kind of home fixture. And that makes a big difference at that level. They've also got plans as well now to move to a new 15,000 all-seater stadium as part of like a Wills multi-sports complex with a multi-purpose arena with the capacity to expand that to 25,000. And the state's ambition of the club is to try and get back in the Championship, which is where they were up until 2001. But at the moment, they're as far away from the Championship as what they could ever possibly be. It's just a shame to see such a team with a good loyal fan base who play in a superb ground for that tier of football. It's 15,000 all-seater stadium. And it's always a fantastic atmosphere. To me, at times, it's a far better atmosphere that I get at many Premier League games. So I really hope they can kind of pull it together. I really hope Nigel Adkins can get the move on the table, because Merseyside needs three teams in the Football League. We've lost two teams over the years to the Football League in Southport and New Brighton. We don't really want to lose another team as well. So I'm really hoping that Nigel Adkins can kind of use his experience, work his magic, and get the team safe again.
I remember the issues when COVID struck and how certain divisions and leagues were calculated. And there's no doubt that Tranmere has sort of cut the sticky end of the stick of the calculations. And it seemed that decision that sort of condemned them, not into relegation, but condemned them to a bit of a spiral of decline. Aidan, what do you think? I mean, it's obviously difficult to say, and you know, there's no right answer in that sort of situation. I mean, it's totally unprecedented, but it seems that Tranmere was sort of had a good kick in, shall we say, and are still trying to recover from that.
It's a question of the timing, isn't it? You know, if it had been a week one way or the other, maybe the totals would have worked out differently. At the other end of that table, I recall Wickham, I think, leapt up a few places because of the new calculation and ended up in the playoffs and getting promoted, I think. So they were the big winner and Tranmere were the loser. It's unfortunate, but I guess it was bound to happen to someone. But yes, unfortunate for Tranmere, it was them. I've got a real soft spot for Tranmere, though. Actually, I've got relatives in the Wirral. My mother's family is all from there. And so I've been to Prenton Park a number of times with my Tranmere supporting cousins, and I've even seen Newcastle win there in the cup once as well back in the day. Most of this was all in better days, though, and this is what I mean with Tranmere. So it's so sad that they fell out the league once, and you know, it's tough to come back once you do, and if it happens again, it would be a real shame because they just seem of a bigger stature. The whole setup seems bigger than the clubs they're in and around. I mean, they're down with the likes of Sutton United, Forest Green, Colchester, and so on. These are the type of teams they're in and around. Now, Tranmere, the setup just seems a lot bigger. And when I think of Tranmere, what I think of mostly is like Pat Nevin and John Aldridge and players like that. And excellent runs in the cup. So close to a League Cup final in the mid-90s, where they were also close to place in the Premier League, potentially at Everton's expense at one time. There was a realistic scenario where the two would swap places.
It was way too close to comfort, that one, Aidan.
It was. It was a real chance, and that would have been quite a turn-up. But they were regularly near the top end of the second tier, occasionally into the third. They were excellent in the Cups for a time. I mentioned that one in the 90s, but then there was also 2000. They reached the League Cup final. Then another great Cup run, I think, was it the year straight after that when they beat Everton and then ultimately lost to Liverpool a bit later on, which must have been great occasions on Merseyside. I mean, even you, Paul, must have appreciated the occasion, if not the actual outcome. But this is the era that I think of when I think of Tranmere. And so seeing them in this current struggle it's a real shame. And I think you can, well, as much they let's be fair, they put themselves in the position where that relegation in the COVID season was a possibility. It was a possibility had the season gone on. So, you know, there is an element of they brought that on themselves. But the misfortune of it all, I guess the feeling of had it been decided on the field of play, they would have had the chance to change things, to turn things around, because there was still a number of games to go. I think it was March that it was actually finally cancelled, and then a little while later they came up with a formula, but they didn't play since March 2020. You're left feeling like with unfinished business, and it's as though that feeling has lingered ever since by the looks of what's happened to them ever since. Sometimes a relegation gives you a chance to reset and rebuild. They had a relegation, they haven't reset and rebuilt, and they're potentially having another relegation. I wouldn't be surprised, because I think last time they went out of the league, they had some real struggles financially, and you know, it isn't an easy thing to do, to fight your way back. Several clubs have gone into oblivion when they've gone. Some have had to resurrect themselves from the ashes and come again as new entities in some cases, because they're sometimes up against teams that are on a much more positive trajectory, and that's very, very hard. If they dropped, you would like to think they'd be okay, and they'd manage to do what, say, Notts County have done last year and come back reinvigorated, a famous old club. But we will see. But hopefully they'll avoid that scenario. There are still two below them right now, and there's a long, long way to go. But it is a real shame. And it's those glory days of Aldridge and Nevin before that, the cup experience, cup exploits, the coming ever so close to the top flight, that always comes to mind when I think of Tranmere. And the days that I've been to see them, which was all in that era, it was always a fun place to go. And as Paul rightly says, it's a stadium I don't think it was all-seater when I went, but it was still an impressive size stadium for the level it's at. It's always had a good level of support. And despite being so close to Everton and Liverpool, it obviously has a bit of a shadow cast over it, but the Wirral's its own entity. It likes to sort of fight for its own place in the scheme of things. It doesn't want to be lumped in as part of Liverpool, which it's not. And so Tranmere gives them some of that. And yes, long may they continue to do so.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, and it's difficult, that sort of COVID situation, but it seems harsh that a club should be thrust into decline because of some mathematical calculation rather than something that happened on the pitch. And you know, as Paul mentioned, you know, they'd signed some new players and looked like they're on a bit of a run. And who knows, if the calculation had been made 2 weeks afterwards, it could have been a different turnout. But let's hope Tranmere can sort of pull it around and go back and, you know, get back on the rise. So talking about things that happen off the pitch, as it were, I'm going to talk about my subject now, which is, please don't turn off, listeners, it's VAR. There's been a big controversy recently with the Liverpool issue against Tottenham, where the communication between the VAR room and the referee seemed to be somewhat awry, causing the problem. And I think, you know, it's a bit difficult. Mistakes are always going to happen. But I want to look at sort of beyond mistakes to things that shouldn't happen, that just shouldn't happen. I'm going to refer back to three games. First one is the League Cup tie at Anfield when Wolves played Liverpool. And a late Wolves goal, which would have been the winning goal, was disallowed for offside. And VAR couldn't correct the referee's, the linesman's decision because they hadn't got a camera in the right place. Now, I have to ask myself, well, I have to ask anybody listening, and especially you guys, why was that? I mean, Anfield is not like, you know, a fourth division ground. It's not like a lower league club. It's a massive ground. Why wasn't the camera in the right place? You know, you see the TV pictures and they seem to suggest that there was no offside. Moving on from there, I want to raise two more issues. Again, one concerning Wolves, which is the game at Luton, where the referee gave a penalty against Wolves. and the VAR wanted to, apparently I read reports about this, and if somebody's going to tell me I'm wrong, then I'm happy to accept that. But the VAR did not want to overrule the referee's decision because he was a young referee and they didn't want to destroy his confidence. Now, from my perspective, you are simply not allowed to make the decision on that basis. You are not allowed. You should make the decision purely on the facts of the event. And just to underscore that, I'm going to refer to another game, which was the opening game of the season. I think it was the first or second game of the season when Chelsea were at home to Spurs. Chelsea were winning towards the end, and there was a corner, and Spurs corner, and I can't remember which Tottenham player it was, grabbed hold of Cucurella's hair and pulled him down. Now, the referee, I think it was Anthony Tarr, didn't see it, but Mike Dean, who was the VAR, and he said this on Sky, I've heard him say it, he did see it and thought it was a foul. Now, whether it was a red card or not is irrelevant, because it should have been a free kick. Chelsea cleared the ball and won the game. As it happened, the corner was retaken, because the ball was clear for a corner, and Spurs equalised. Now, Mike Dean has said that Anthony Tarr had a difficult game and he didn't want to countermand his decision, even though it was a mistake. And I say again, if that is the case, you are simply not allowed to make a decision on that basis. As far as I understand, I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, but the VAR should make the decision, as the referee on the field makes the decision, on the facts of the events. Not because you want to support your mate or because you think this referee needs support because he's young. So it's up to you guys. Aidan, thoughts?
The whole thing is such an astonishing shambles. You referenced Mike Dean there. There's obviously a fairly highly viewed clip of him and Paul Merson having a bit of a set to on Sky Sports in the light of the recent incidents where he is claiming, well, you can't just change the rule. You have to do this. You have to follow the rule, because they couldn't call the game back once it had restarted. This the very same Mike Dean that you're talking about there, who didn't want to shout up when an offence occurs because he didn't want to make things awkward for the referee who'd had a hard time. It's absolutely farcical. I don't really know where VAR goes from here. It hasn't resolved the issues it was meant to resolve. It's just caused a different type of argument. We still have contentious decisions. We still have disagreements. We still have arguments and low satisfaction and conspiracy theories and all of this. In fact, I would say the conspiracy theories are probably greater than they ever were, because things are being reviewed in such finite detail. I understand why calls were there for VAR in the first place, and I didn't think it would ever be as bad as this, but they've managed to do it in such a way that it is. The audio of the incident recently, when the game restarted following Liverpool's non-goal, as it turned out to be, is just astonishing when you listen back to that, the conversations they had, how the only person in the room who was aware that the referee had not awarded a goal in the first place was the tech guy. And it was down to him to flag up to the VAR officials and the assistant VAR official, several of them. It was down to him to shout up to them that, are you sure you're happy with this decision? They said it was offside and you're saying it's not. Are you sure? But the game had restarted. Oh, nothing we can do. Nothing we can do. It's just absolutely laughable. Quite how they couldn't have just said, right, we will stop it. Because after all, you know, we've seen in recent times a penalty given after full time because of an incident that happened just before that had got reviewed. Why they couldn't have just called it back and just stopped play and said, it's a goal. Sorry, we didn't call it in time. Correct the decision, get it right. I don't think the criticism would have been remotely as bad for slightly bending that law than it is for what's actually happened. But where does VAR go from here? I think the lessons from some other sports is that being able to hear the conversation really, really helps. I don't know of any other sport that uses video assistant or video technology that doesn't have the conversation between the referee and the TV officials available, whether that's just for TV or whether people in the ground can get a little earpiece that connects to it like you can in rugby. I don't know. But in one way or another, the audio really would help to know what's going on. It would hopefully then pick up this kind of issue. It would be a bit more obvious and harder to bypass. The other way I think it could be changed is to just make it a challenge system instead of being there all the time. Teams could challenge a decision maybe a certain number of times. There's a bit NFL style there where you get a certain number of challenges. If you get your challenge correct, you get to maintain it. Tennis, similar. If you get it wrong, you lose your challenge. And, you know, if you use it up on something frivolous, that's your loss. In this case, Liverpool would have challenged and they would have won the challenge and would have got a goal. I don't know. That's the only way I can see it working out better. The only bit of technology that I think is absolutely spot on and I have no issue with is the goal line technology. And I know that's gone wrong once as well, but that is something where even offside has that slight subjectivity of when is the ball actually passed and which TV frame picks that up. And then going down to whether your armpit sticks out beyond somebody's toe is just too much. Although I guess you have to have a line somewhere. It's just too complicated. It's too precise in some ways. And then even then it doesn't work, as we saw in this particular game. So my third option is scrap it altogether.
Before we sort of move on to Paul Askey's opinion, I just want to sort of focus on a couple of things. Firstly, the referee gave offside. If VAR wasn't there, the referee would have been offside and still wrong. So VAR didn't really... Yep. Yeah, that was just a preamble,
VAR's,
really.
VAR's only got one job in the situation to correct that decision, and it didn't. So, yes, we've ended up with the same result, but we've got the technology. So in the past, sure, it would have been wrong, and Liverpool would have had a big complaint, but not as big as this one.
I think the point is, it's not VAR that made that was wrong. It was the person watching, the people watching that made it wrong, not VAR, the technology. But the Liverpool-Tottenham one was just a preamble. The main point I wanted to make was that VAR officials seem to be making decisions not on the events on the pitch, rather than that they seem to have sort of other issues that have, say, clouding their judgment, perhaps deciding their judgment, rather than the events on the pitch. And I'm happy to accept I'm wrong if somebody tells me, but there's the reports I've read, certainly the Luton Wolves game and on the Chelsea Spurs game, the VAR decision wasn't informed, wasn't decided by what the picture showed. It was what an emotional decision of the guy watching. Now, I would ask you a simple question. Is that simply unacceptable?
Well, I would agree, Gary, on that aspect. Yeah, it's totally unacceptable. Just on the one thing you did say, that it's not VAR that's the issue, it's the person using it. Well, the only aspect of the technology that is fully automated is the goal line technology. VAR...
Yeah.
Sure, it's technology, but it always requires a person. So you still always have that decision. You have that subjectivity. So, you know, VAR can be great, but you'll never remove the human aspect. So those errors will still be there. The other points you're making, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's beyond ludicrous that anything other than the rules would come into play when you're making those decisions. As much as I'm advocating a slight bending of it in this case, that would be to see the correct decision made. Here, you're talking about instances where the wrong decision was made to avoid hurting somebody's feelings.
Poor thoughts.
Yeah, but as an Everton fan watching the Liverpool Tottenham game, I thought it worked really well, the VAR and the match together. So I don't really see what the problem is.
Good process, boys. Isn't that what they said? Good process.
I thought it worked well at every level. So what Liverpool fans are complaining about, I've no idea. But on a more serious note, I think you've both touched upon this. And so it can be one of my big things as well, is that, to me, being the match official and being the VAR adjudicator are two completely different skills. And going back to what you said there, Gary, I think the problem is, because the referees are refereeing one week, the VAR officials the next week, inevitably they're a very close-knit group. So they will try to defend each other. They will try to dig the friends out of a hole. You know, I'm sure when they meet up, there's a few words saying, why did you pull that one back? You know, I thought I made the right decision there. So there's all of that element to it as well. And I've always thought that it's a different skill watching the game on TV to officiating in a match as well. And I think you need different levels of capability for that. I think the other thing as well is most of our referees, apart from the younger ones, aren't a particularly IT savvy generation. So they've kind of made it to the top of their level and maybe have not got the requisite IT capabilities compared to maybe some younger people. And I just think, is it time to look at two routes for officials. One, you can train to be an official in a ground, or two, you can train to be a VAR official. Because to me, they're two different skill sets. Now, I'm sure there's all sorts of impracticalities in that, but that's something I've always looked upon as, you know, something that's worth exploring. Second thing I'd always wondered as well is, if you're going to stick with match officials as VAR adjudicators, well, why not bring in officials from say Scotland, because, you know, they might not have the same social set together, or from Italy or Spain, and to give their view about what's happening as well. I found it quite interesting the when Howard Webb first took over, one of the things he insisted upon was that the VAR officials dress as referees when they're in the studio, because I couldn't believe they'll turn up in jeans and t-shirts to make decisions. Because I know from when I worked as a teacher, when you came in on inset days, dressing your civvies, you just weren't in the same mindset as what you were when you had the suits and tile. It just changed your way of thinking. It creates a far more relaxed atmosphere. So I think that's been a good step forward as well. I mean, basically, VAR's here to stay. We're not going to get around that. The technology should work. You know, as both of you indicated, goal line technology is more or less worked as well. I think all these controversies, to me, kind of get blown massively out of proportion as well. So although there's been some horrendous decisions made, and you both given great examples of that, it kind of bypasses the number of correct decisions that are made as well that don't quite get the same publicity. One of the things that really annoys me is, as a fan in the crowd, A, you don't know whether to celebrate a goal anymore or not, because the first thing you can do is look at the screen. Is it a VAR check? Secondly, if you're in the ground, you don't know what's going on, because, as both of you said there, you don't hear the conversation between the match official and the people back at Stockley Park. And I hate the way the TV gets to know the outcome before the paying fan in the ground. To me, that is wrong on every level. Why should the armchair fan know what's happening before the person who's paid his good money or her good money to be at the stage and watching the game live? So I think one thing they have to change is the TV audience can wait for the decision. Give it the decision in the ground first, because I think Sky loves VAR. I think it generates interest in the game. I think it builds an audience, and it's almost like it appeals to the mindset of the people who don't go to football matches but are quite happy to watch the entertainment in their own house. I think that the match going fee paying fan kind of gets forgotten all this, but yeah, I just think it's here to stay. And the decision you had is there, Gary. Yeah, it shouldn't have happened. And Mike Dean, I mean, God, I think because he's now on his alternative career, I think he's looking to create controversy. That thing about the Chelsea-Tottenham game, he said he's helping his mates out. Well, I mean, that was serialised in the Mail on Sunday, I think. I think he's a columnist for them as well. So he's obviously been told, well, come up with something controversial, Mike, and it's a bit of a monthly bonus if you get a few more hits on social media. So whether I believe him about that or not, I really don't know. Do you remember a story a couple of seasons ago? Anthony Taylor had a particularly poor game, and it later emerged it had been his stag night, and a load of the match officials had all gone out in the stag night together. Well, that kind of shows you the kind of camaraderie behind it, which is great on one level. But whether it allows you to be impartial enough when you're judging things that far, I don't know. And going back to what Aidan said there as well, there's always going to be mistakes, and because it's human interpretation. You know, whether we go down the World Cup model of, you know, the semi-automated offside system, possibly, at least it takes a person's judgment out of that as well. You mentioned there, Gary, about Anfield, but the wrong camera angles. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to use the technology, A, it's got to be the best technology, and B, it's got to work. Otherwise, it's pointless, haven't it?
Yeah, quite right. I mean, just very briefly, we move on. The sort of Anfield camera angle, well, it's never happened in any other game at Anfield, as far as my knowledge is aware. And, you know, I mean, if you're there to judge offside, for God's sake, put your camera in.
Yeah, but the way Anfield is designed is that the distance is never going to get a decision from VAR. So it's the way they built the stadium deliberately. so that's why there's no getting around that, you see.
Yeah, I understand, and I'm sure certain Mr. Scrabble will be sort of waving his finger at the Yeah, okay. So let's put VAR back in the box, and let's look forward. So Paul, come to you first for your sort of looking into the future. Where are you going to go to, buddy?
Well, and I'll be there as well. It's the FA Cup fourth qualifying round this Saturday. I love the FA Cup. I know me and Dave Bowler totally agree on this one as well. And to me, this is the most intriguing part of the FA Cup, because you get the National League teams joining in now. And the prize is, in the first round proper, you got the chance of joining a big club, so like Portsmouth, a Derby County, a Charlton Athletic, a Bolton Wanderers at home. massive payday. So I'm always fascinated by this final qualifying round. You've got 19 ex-league clubs in this qualifying round, which kind of shows you the strength and depth of teams out there still in the competition. And there's some, you know, there's some potentially really, really cracking ties there. You've got AFC Fylde, who almost made the Football League two or three seasons ago. They got to the playoff final. Who will be playing Leigh Town, who are the lowest ranked team in the competition. They're currently step four, I think, Northern Premier League West. You've got a great, what would have been an old fourth division game, Hartlepool against Chester, two ex-league clubs. You've got Hereford, FA Cup traditional giant killers against Rochdale, another old league fixture. You've got the revitalised Robbie Savage's Macclesfield, who are now away to Alfreton Town and looking back to getting the first round proper. You've got another traditional giant killing team in Altrincham, who are playing Oldham in the fourth qualifying round. And one time, I'm keeping my eye upon it. This team, I think, did well in the FA Cup last year. Is Cray Valley Paper Mills against Enfield, who is a non-league team, had a tremendous tradition of cup glory, Wembley appearances, etc. So definitely keep my eye on that one. But from a personal point of view, I should be at FC Halifax on Saturday, supporting my local non-league team, Marine, in their qualifying tie there. And it brings back memories of 1992, when the original Halifax, before they reformed, played against Marine in the first round of the College Road when they were a fourth division team. And Jimmy Case was the player manager, I think. And Marine won 4-1 in what was like a fantastic moment for the community where I live in North Liverpool and Crosby. And really looking forward to seeing this game, because I think it's well known that Marine kind of came to national prominence with the cup run a few seasons ago when they played Tottenham Hotspur. We touched upon football finances, a little bit of a trend there, but the difference that has made to Marine in terms of the income it generated, in terms of the profile it gave them, and also they suddenly access massive amounts of money that they couldn't have dreamed of having before. And because they're run by a sensible, long-serving board and committee, they're not like one of these maverick clubs that go splurging the money everywhere. They've used it quite creatively, quite sensibly. They've installed an artificial pitch. It's being used by the community 7 days a week. They've massively improved the social side of the club. You can have a drink before the game. You can take your drinks in when you're watching the game. And, you know, this strange idea that a football fan can drink alcohol and not turn into a Raven Whoever would have believed that? And but it's just great the way the whole club was transformed from that. And I look at other teams in this qualifying round thing. For one of these teams, as happened with Marine, you just need to get to the first round proper. If you get to the first round proper, you get one or two favourable draws, suddenly you're in the third round, and everything's a possibility again. I mean, your part of the world, Aidan, Blythe Spartans, renowned cup team from the 80s, 90s, always a banana skin for football league teams who didn't want to face that. And it's just great for these teams that they get a bit of profile, they get a bit of publicity. And I know the FA Cup has lots of critics. And, you know, it's still frustrating that even teams sometimes in the Championship, League One, League Two, will field a weaker team in the FA Cup. Why on earth would you do that? It's a great competition. It's, you know, it's the oldest football, knockout football competition in the world. And I'll be keeping my eye on all the results on Saturday and see how many of these teams will get through to make it the first round proper.
Good call, buddy. I think football fans of a certain generation, you know, will sort of retain a great love of the FA Cup and what it represents. You know, a lot of, you know, the Premier League, you know, for the younger generation of fans, you know, those perhaps understand why clubs put weakened teams there. But, you know, for most of the clubs in the Premier League, or, you know, you're not going to win the Premier League and you're not going to qualify for Europe. So why don't you have a go at the Cup? Why put weakened teams out? And, you know, as you say, the magic of the Cup is still alive for teams like those you mentioned. Aidan, thoughts?
Yeah, what struck me looking down the list is what Paul's alluded to there, is a lot of the, just how many former league teams there are in this draw. You know, Paul's mentioned some of the ties, right? There's also like Torquay, Maidstone and Yeovil, who I know have had various cup runs through the 80s before they became a league club in more recent times. They're playing Southend, another team down on the luck. You mentioned the Altrincham-Oldham one. I mean, Oldham were cup semi-finalists. Well, I think it's not that long ago, but I guess it's 30 years ago or so now. Time flies. But, it, you know, they've gone from cup semi-finalists to a non-league team playing Altrincham in the final qualifying round of the cup. I mean, that's quite a change in fortune. Gateshead are in there as well from our area playing Stourbridge. So, yes, I'll certainly be looking out for both Blyth and Gateshead to see how they get on, as well as Marine, obviously, Paul. But it's that sheer number of league of what I consider, I get it wrong, they're not league teams, but what I've always considered to be league teams. That's very wrong of me to say it quite like that to all the teams who've gone up and replaced them and done quite well in many cases. That, you know, it's good that there is that flow of teams, but it just still seems odd to see some of the teams, some of the team names that my mind anyway, thinks of as being slightly higher up the chain. But equally, it's the other aspect of it as well, is the opportunity for some of these much lower down clubs, not just the sort of top level National League clubs who should be able to compete with many a league side, but those from slightly further down, to making it to the fourth round of qualifying is a big achievement in itself. But now you've got that huge carrot dangling. What I find absolutely awful though is if they get through here and then get drawn against another non-league team, that just feels almost like a waste, that one of them then has to miss out on the chance of playing a league side, because that is obviously what they're all after. I think it's absolutely terrific when we get non-league teams punching above their weight in the first round, second and third round proper of the cup. It adds to its appeal massively. And we all know they're not going to go too far, but it's nice to see just how far some of them can get. And it's always quite intriguing as you get through the rounds to see the last man standing, if you like, from the non-league sides, and just how far they can sometimes go. So yes, it is quite interesting. In my youth and so on, I never really paid attention to the qualifying rounds, other than knowing they happened, and then it all comes along to the league aspects later on. But I think increasingly the interest is growing in the teams how they have to battle to get through. You know, they've always had things on Football Focus or St. Greaves and so on, where they're following a team through from the earlier rounds. We just pay it a bit of mind and then you move on. But seeing so many of these bigger names, plus some that I've frankly never heard of, all competing for a place in the first round proper of the Cup is absolutely terrific. And I hope those who do make it through get suitable reward with a league side, preferably at home.
Hear, hear, hear. Okay, Aidan, so moving on to you now. What's looking forward? Where are you taking us, buddy?
Where am I taking us? I'm taking us 5 years forward, in fact, in time, to Euro 2028. And by the time this pod comes out, it may have been rubber stamped. I think that's happening on Tuesday. But with Turkey withdrawing from bidding for 2028, for Euro 2028, in favour of joining forces with Italy for 2032, the UK and Ireland are about to be confirmed as hosts for 2028. Now, this is quite an exciting prospect, I think. You know, the 2021 edition, 2020 brackets one edition, as I should call it. It did have games at Wembley, of course, and Hampden Park, and it concluded at Wembley, but it never quite had that proper tournament feel for several reasons. One of them obviously being COVID and the reduced crowds at many venues throughout. It was only by the semi and final that Wembley, I think, was able to get full crowds. It didn't go entirely well in the final from the crowd perspective either, but that's something that might have to be looked at. UEFA had obviously wanted to give themselves a big football market to host 2028 after presumably not making the kind of money they thought they would from the last Euros. I think they'll do well in Germany next year. That's obviously a huge football market and an excellent place to watch football. But the UK and Ireland will be absolutely terrific as well. The stadiums that are to be used have been announced, and include yours and mine, Paul. At least your soon-to-be new stadium, if they get it done. It's a bit of a coup for Everton, I would think, as was the case in 1966, of course. Indeed. And St. James will be flying the flag for the North East, quite rightly, I like to think. And the Etihad, rather than Old Trafford, for Manchester, which is another interesting one, given capacities. Wembley and Tottenham in London, Villa Park being the other English one. And then there's also Cardiff, Dublin, Glasgow and Belfast, although there are possibly questions over the proposed Casement Park Stadium in Belfast, given it's currently a wasteland and development is hitting issues with, I think, both the GAA and the lack of a functioning Stormont government. So I hope that one gets sorted out, because the last thing we want with it being an entire UK and Ireland bid is for one of those constituent nations to not be able to host. And Northern Ireland is obviously the one with the fewest options when it comes to venues that they could possibly do this in. There simply isn't one currently. So hopefully that one does get itself sorted. But a few questions do come to mind from it all. The first is whether all five nations would qualify automatically. Now, UEFA, I think, from what I've seen, would be expecting all five to go through the standard qualifying process. Obviously, normally the hosts are straight in, and when there's been co-hosting before, so that was Poland and Ukraine in 2012, Austria, Switzerland before them, and the Netherlands and Belgium before that, they were both given qualifying places. But that's two out of 16, as it was in those cases. Okay, so this is out of 24 now, but five is quite a lot. And from what I understand, UEFA are not willing to extend that hosting guarantee to five places. So this does actually open up the possibility of host nations missing out on their own tournament. Now, I know the last Euros had that as well, because it was spread all over Europe and in some nations that didn't qualify. But that wasn't a normal tournament by any stretch of the imagination, given the way that was set up with the hosting literally all over the place. This is a focused bid. It is UK and Ireland, British Isles. For one of them to miss out would be a real shame. The chance for, to take one example, Northern Ireland's fans to see their nation play a finals tournament game in Belfast, for Ireland to see a finals tournament game in Dublin, and so on. It would be devastating for that not to happen, given the makeup of this bid. But I think even with the expanded Euros, and for some nations, it's harder not to qualify. But I think there will be a few of these host nations who would be on the cusp of the margins of whether they would make it in or not. And so it would be disappointing to miss out. Another question, I guess, is would the final be at Wembley again? Obviously, we've just had a final at Wembley, and you'd have to imagine it would be, given size, capacity-wise, and so on. But what of the security concerns? Obviously, the last Euros final at Wembley was a security disaster. The UEFA's own report, or the independent report into it, even suggested they were fortunate, or it could have easily caused death. Now, this is no trivial matter, obviously. So there are major concerns there. But then again, I suppose Paris has had those kind of issues in recent times, as Liverpool fans would certainly know. And it hasn't stopped them hosting other events either. So maybe that's not such an issue. And my final question, I guess, that it brings up to mind is quite a crucial one for me, is who will be playing at St. James's Park, and will I get tickets? But that sort of just shows the sort of enthusiasm it can give. My kids are excited by the prospect. And as much as this is still 5 years away, the chance to see a tournament on our doorstep would be wonderful for them, and equally for this big kid here.
Picking a few items out of that, Paul, we're going to throw some sort of questions to yourself. Firstly, given scattergun settings of the previous tournament, or God knows how many different countries, is it sensible to sort of condense it into a much more smaller space? And what would it sort of detract from the tournament if none of the host countries, none of the, so Scotland, England, Wales, Northern Ireland, UK, sorry, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland actually qualified?
I think in the case of the scenario you just outlined there, Gary, yeah, I think undoubtedly that would detract from the tournament. But I think given the strength of it, I think it'd be highly unlikely that England wouldn't qualify. I think things in the Scotland's progress, thing. They'd like to qualify. So, yeah, but undoubtedly, if that were to happen, it would be a blow to the tournament. I'm sure the organisers have in mind that is not going to be the case. In terms of it being spread across five quite adjacent countries, as opposed to spread over the continent, I think logistically that's a far better idea. Going back to what Aidan's been saying there as well, you referenced your kids there, Aidan, that, you know, for the younger generation coming through, What a fabulous opportunity this is going to be. What a fabulous experience this is going to be. Now, and with all five nations having the chance to host at least one or two games in their country, I think that's going to really generate lots of interest. And I think you have to accept, don't you, that I can't see England getting a World Cup maybe the next 30, 40 years. So but we're going to have to make the most. I mean, the 2014 was all the World Cup going to stay in the Middle East. So I think what you're going to have to accept is that we're going to have to make the most of the Euros, because that's probably the most prestigious competition we're going to get our hands on. And you know, I went to two games in Euro 21. I went to the two Italy Spain semi final at Wembley, the Croatia Czech Republic game at Hampden Park, and it was just a great, fabulous experience as well. And it's I'm delighted we've been given the opportunity to host it. Like you, Aidan, I share your concerns about Casement Park, and I also have concerns about, you know, there has to be some way that even if the likes of Northern Ireland or the Republic of Wales don't qualify automatically, there's got to be some kind of route where you might be able to have a last go at maybe making it. Because I think it's important that if you're hosting competition, that your country should be playing there. And I do have huge concerns about Casement Park, whether that's going to be ready on time or not. I know Windsor Park's capacity is only about 15,000, so I'm not quite sure whether they're going to be lined up as a replacement. In terms of where the final will be held, I think that's a really intriguing discussion. Not being anti-Scottish here, believe me, but Hampden Park just hasn't, to me, it's not a football stadium, it's an athletic stadium. So Wembley is better from that point of view. But you know, you can see a real case for Wales getting it, because I think the Principality Stadium would be an excellent venue for a Euros final as well. So there's a few possibilities there. And I'm not quite sure, are there one or two reserve grounds in that list as well, in case anyone pulls out?
Not from the latest list that they put out in the news stories recently. There obviously were others on a longer list earlier on that have fallen by the wayside. But no, these are the final 10 as it stands. But yeah, you're right. They may need to alter that if Belfast can't quite do it.
And as you quite rightly pointed out as well, that there has to be an opportunity for the local population to get preferential treatment for games in their city. So, you know, I'd be more than happy that, you know, in your case at Newcastle, that when tickets are allocated, you know, 50% at least of the tickets are given to people who live within the area initially, because I think, you know, what you don't want is the local population to be bumped off the list for the corporate jamborees and hospitality packages. So I think that's really important. And also that it's affordable. Don't price families with young kids out of the competition. You know, make it affordable, and also make sure that each stadium gets its fair selection of decent teams. So that Newcastle, you know, maybe get the possibility to have a Holland there, or Belgium there, or Spain there, or France there, sort of high stature to give the fans something to remember. And I think the people your kids say is there, Aidan, something they're going to remember for the rest of their life. I mean, I remember the World Cup in Goodison '66 when I was 10. It's never gone away from me. So those memories will linger with them. So it's a fantastic opportunity. And you really hope that all the nations who are hosting can qualify, and that it just ends up being a fabulous tournament.
Good stuff. Okay. Well, if Aidan was projecting forward a few years, I'm going to go a couple of years beyond that. I'm going to talk about the 2030 World Cup. Now, I mean, the next World Cup coming up has been slated for Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Three countries. Well, you know, I think that's a pretty wide geographic spell given the size of North America. But, you know, where UEFA is sort of concentrating into a smaller geographical area for their tournament, as Aidan was just talking about, the 2030 World Cup is not spread across three countries, it's spread across three continents. So we've got games that are taking place in Uruguay, Paraguay and Argentina in South America, but what is being described as the opening games. I'm not really sure what that means, but the opening games, I presume it means some group games. And then the tournament moving on to Spain, Portugal and Morocco. Now, to my mind, I mean, having a tournament in Portugal and Spain, perhaps even Morocco, makes sense. Having a tournament in Argentina, Paraguay and Uruguay, I mean, Uruguay especially, because it's the 100th centenary of the first World Cup in 1930, that again makes sense. But to me, running a tournament across six countries in three different continents just seems, I mean, okay, and just, you know, taking on board what you were saying there, Paul, about, you know, giving the locals a chance to watch some decent games and keeping prices reasonable. You know, it's difficult to think that these World Cup decisions, venues are driven by anything other than financial considerations. I mean, perhaps this is me with my cynical head on, but, you know, that's what life has taught me. The way FIFA operates, you know, the the motto is for the good of the game. Are you having a laugh, lads? It's for the good of the bank account. Aidan, thoughts?
Oh, so many thoughts on this. It's ludicrous. I don't know. FIFA, in this instance, I think they're so desperate to be seen to be doing something to acknowledge the centenary while not daring to actually give the tournament to South America because finances dictate that the better bid, and the better bid by all accounts was that from Spain, Portugal, Morocco. But they're so desperate to do something to be seen to be marking the centenary properly that they've come up with this absolutely ludicrous fudge. Now, I've seen some outline plans for this. I don't know how official or correct these may be, whether they're just a tentative discussion point or what. But what I saw was that the tournament might be extended from 4 or 4 and a bit weeks to 6, with the opening 3 games in South America, one in each of those host nations, a week ahead or so of the start of the tournament proper back in Spain, Portugal, and Morocco. I say tournament proper, the games out in South America would be part of the proper tournament, but so separate from it as to allow lots of travel and acclimatization time back to Europe for the teams involved. It just makes it utterly, utterly farcical. There's a consistency of that. So 3 opponents would have to travel down to South America to face Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay if they were all given host spaces in it. Who knows? Mind you, from South America to qualify, it's very hard not to. In the expanded 48-team tournament, there's only 3 of them won't qualify. So the chances are these 3 would. 3 opponents will have to travel all the way down there for their opening games and then travel back to Europe for their others. As far as I'm aware, it'll only be 1 game in each venue, so 1 game for each of those host nations. Well, what impact might that have on the group overall? So the other 2 teams in the group won't have to travel to South America and back. It screws it up, and I appreciate the next tournament's going to have huge distances to travel as well, but not within each group. I think they'll be based locally, and then if you then have to travel to the other end of the continent, it'll be for a knockout game. You won't be having to travel from one side of the world to the other just to complete your group. That is astonishing. Then, let's get on to the environment. So, FIFA claimed that Qatar 2022 was going to be a carbon neutral World Cup because it didn't involve all this travel, had these stadiums they could take down and build somewhere else and all this kind of stuff. Nobody had to take internal flights except all the people who had to fly in and out of Dubai and Jeddah all the time. However, FIFA's own report into that showed that that suggestion, that claim, was absolute rubbish. Now, this is the same organization that is claiming to want to offset environmental factors, offset the carbon, make things neutral, etc., etc. So what's a good way of doing that? Oh, yeah, let's have a World Cup that spans over 3 continents. Now, traveling from Spain to Morocco, from southern Spain to Morocco, is no different than traveling from southern Spain to northern Spain in terms of that travel. I don't have any problem with that because they're all, like we're saying with UK and Ireland, all in the same vicinity. Easy to get around, lots of transport links even across to Morocco. No problems with that. But South America, that's just ridiculous. Making teams travel all that way, press, media travel all that way. Who knows what will happen with fans? Would any away fans go all the way down there? I don't know. This all just, it baffles me. The impact then on Portugal, Spain, Morocco, it's essentially their tournament, but it's now going to have this odd South American asterisk against it. So yeah, it's kind of their tournament, but not entirely. You've got this other weird bit. They just seem to be wanting to do something or wanting to be seen to be do something to acknowledge the centenary. But they could have done this in so many other ways. Why actually make the World Cup this weird mess just to acknowledge the fact that it began in Uruguay? Could they not have celebrated their centenary with something like they did in 1980 for the 50 years? They had this Mundialito tournament of the previous World Cup winners, except England, who didn't bother to turn up, and the Dutch went instead. Why not do something like that? Or just simply a celebratory clash between Uruguay and Argentina in the Centenario, Montevideo, to not quite reenact, but to commemorate the first World Cup final. I don't see why you have to turn the World Cup into this weird tribute to what happened 100 years ago, when the bids aren't judged on sentimental value, they're judged on their merit or their financial merit. And the Spanish, Portugal, Morocco bid was the strongest one. I just don't get it. I also don't see where Paraguay come into all this. I other than the purely coincidental fact, I am sure, the CONMEBOL's headquarters are in Asunción, Paraguay. I'm sure that's nothing to do with it, but that is just a fact I would like to point out. Chile were also part of the South American 2030 bid, but they're nowhere to be seen in this compromise. They don't have the head of CONMEBOL in Santiago. Anyway, this also paves the path for Saudi 2034, of course, because they've decided since CONCACAF's having the next one and three continents are taken out with this one, that only Asia and Oceania can bid for 2034. Saudi is already the preferred bid of AFC, the Asian Federation, and unless Australia can combine with New Zealand in some way, then Saudi will win that one. And that is the end game of all of this. So, yes, I'm utterly mystified. On a slightly more positive view, just to flag some other World Cup, while we're on a World Cup theme, qualifiers for the current, well, the next World Cup are already underway in some continents while we're all thinking of Euros still. And in fact, 10 teams will get eliminated this week from World Cup contention already with the first preliminary round of Asian qualifiers. It's just seems so harsh to me that 10 countries will be eliminated some 3 years out of the tournament after only two games. That's such a long time ahead of the tournament. But I just wanted to flag that bit as well. But that's at least given me a smile to replace the look of frustration that this whole 2030 concept has. I hope it doesn't take away from what ought to be a really good vibe to the whole thing in Spain and Portugal and Morocco. I think it's great that Morocco get the opportunity to host when they missed out so many times. Morocco is a terrific place. It's a great place to go, a great place to visit. And I can only anticipate that football there would be one hell of an experience. I think they'll bring something to it, especially off the back of their huge success at the last World Cup. I think that's absolutely terrific that they're getting the opportunity to host. Portugal, likewise. Spain could probably have managed it on their own, but this works out really, really well. The other aspect, ludicrous. Mark their centenary in some other way. Just daft.
Can I just ask, did you say there are 48 teams going to be in the finals in 2030? Did you say 48 teams? I just despair. I mean, 48 teams. You might as well say, I'll tell you what, everybody can be in the World Cup finals. I mean, it's just poor. Help me out, buddy.
It's too far.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with everything that Aidan yourself has said there. It's just a bizarre concept about the way this is all kind of being cobbled together. I mean, so many questions run through my mind here. So are we saying that the six countries that host the World Cup this time, they all get unauthorized qualification place? I don't know. I think as well, you can look at the long-term planning of FIFA about how they think things through, because once the decision was made to host the 2026 World Cup in North America, there was no way 2030 is going to be held in South America, because it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. So I think you're right, said I think they've come up with a desperate fudge here, you know, to try and keep, you know, the CONMEBOL representatives on the FIFA committee happy by having a few token games in South America. This idea of extending the competition to 6 weeks, I know the Rugby World Cup tends to last for 6 weeks, but I think they see it more of a bashing against what modern footballers do. And I just think 6 weeks is way, way, way too long for a competition like that as well. You look at the Olympics as a parallel. So the first Olympics was 1896, so everyone kind of thought Athens would get the 1996 Olympics, but they didn't. They went to Atlanta instead. So just because this is a significant anniversary doesn't mean you're tied to have to commemorate that anniversary by taking the competition back there again. And let's face it, the world in 1930 was a completely different place to the world as it is now. And the more you read about the 1930 World Cup, it was basically that Uruguay offered to build all these stages and pay for the teams to come and travel there, that they actually got the chance to host the competition. And it's kind of, you know, and now in the modern world, they lose now to richer countries who can afford to host the whole competition. I think a tournament based in Spain, Portugal, Morocco would work perfectly in terms of travel distance. I think you're right as well, in Morocco has to be given the chance to host the World Cup, particularly in like their semi-final achievements in the last competition. But in terms of the connectivity between those three countries, well, that to me works perfectly. How they decide who the teams are going to play in South America, I've no idea. How they decide what formats the competition are going to play in South America, I've no idea. And it just kind of affects whatever the outcome is. I mean, unless you go down the route of, all the teams in the Americas and Caribbean play their first game in South America and then have a significant gap while they travel to Europe. That might be what they're thinking. I don't know. But it's just a strange combination. And looking forward to 2034, for all this brief about FIFA wants to expand the game, but Oceania has never had the chance to organise a men's World Cup. And to me, I'd far obviously 2034 hosting Oceania in Australia and New Zealand than I would do in Saudi Arabia. And I just think it's really unfortunate that, you know, money talks and the Asia Committee is going to throw its weight behind Saudi, which is, if you're Australia, who've now joined the Asian groups, you must be thinking, well, hang on, you know, is no one going to back us up here? So that's another concern of mine as well. But yeah, I mean, the planning, the thought, the process, you know, it's all guided by money, unfortunately. And you do fear for what plan UEFA is going to come up next for the World Cup. You know, we've been 1916 World Cup, as Gary kind of indicated there, you know, with a game in the North Pole to attract the Euros. I've no idea where they're going to go with this, but it's I think we're stuck with it and we're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, just a sort of closing point on there. You've got to think that given there's going to be one game, from what Aidan says, it looks like there's going to be one game in each of those South American countries. The odds are if there's 48 teams there, those six countries hosting will probably get automatic qualification. If that's the case, you can't imagine the game in Argentina not featuring Argentina, the game in Paraguay not featuring Paraguay, and the game in Uruguay not featuring Uruguay. You can't imagine the game in Uruguay being Poland against Egypt. It's just not going to happen, is it? So it's always almost like a strange, you know, as Aidan says, tick box exercise almost to sort of fulfill a perceived obligation that perhaps isn't there in reality. Anyway, there we go. So that was today's Football Times. Massive thanks to the guys. Aidan, thank you, buddy. Had fun.
Cheers, Gary. Absolutely. Always have fun on these. It's good to have a rant, good to get things off your chest, and you feel so much better after.
Yeah, I love having a rant, especially about FIFA. And, you know, Paul, thanks, buddy. Had fun.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for inviting me onto the show, Gary. Thanks to yourself for hosting. Always so rewarding listening to you and Aidan give your insights into football, the modern game, your knowledge about current events in football and past events as well. Enjoyed the whole thing. And definitely would look forward to being involved again in the future. And as I said at the start, it's good to have the A-team back again.
Bless your cotton socks, buddy. And finally, thank you to you for listening in. And this week's Today's Football Times from These Football Times. Catch us again on the next podcast. We'll see you then. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.